All right. Well, we're here to the last session, and I want to say thank you for the opportunity to be here and to meet some of you. I've met and I've known a lot more people than I first realized. So it was really good to be here. And the hospitality, just the kindness that you've shown. So this topic, you are the salt of the earth. It comes from Matthew chapter 5, verse 13, words of Jesus. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt hath lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing, but to be cast out and to be trodden under the foot of men. And again, I just want to read the sermon description here because I think it helps us really center the topic a little bit. We don't need to join Turning Point USA. The kingdom of Jesus already gives us a mission far older, more adventurous, and more dangerous, and more rewarding than any current political rally of the Christian conservatives. How can we invite our young people and women to this challenge? How can peaceful Anabaptists change America, starting in our own neighborhoods and nearby cities? We serve a king who turned the world upside down, not with power, but with love. Okay, so there's some questions in here. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to answer those all conclusively. In short, I would say one of the ways we as peaceful Anabaptists can change America is not being compromised, is not being salt that has lost its savor. And I want to circle around to that at some point. But this statement that I just read, I believe would represent a very, very small portion of professing Christians in America today. So I'm assuming, I looked it up, and there's roughly, give or take, let's say 200 million people in America that identify as Christians. I'm not sure how many conservative Anabaptists there are in America that would hold to this, but let's just say roughly 500,000. 500,000 out of 200 million. I didn't even put a percentage on, but it's small. So, and this is my this is where I like to, my apologetics side comes out a little bit, because I really like to, I think in light of that small percentage that we represent, such a small part that believes this statement, I think it's important to look at the counter arguments and to at least see what they're saying and then try to dismantle it and try to, I want to show you where I think some of the wrong premises are. And again, I want to reflect, I think, what's already been said, that I want to say very respectfully, carefully, non-judgmentally of these people, of Turning Point USA, of Charlie, but I do disagree with them. And I know Charlie Kirk was murdered, and of course he's got a family and a wife, and so I want to, there's probably a very, very small chance that Charlie Kirk will hear any of these, or his family or any of them will hear these messages. And I don't mind if they do, because I don't mind if we counter their arguments. But I do want to say that as a fellow human being, and even as professing Christians, I want to be respectful. So, Charlie Kirk, at one of his Q&As that he was famous for having, a man come up to the mic, and I want to go through the discussion that the ensuing discussion that they had. The man came up to the mic and he said this. He said more, but this was just mainly the main part. He said, "I want to be patriotic, but I don't want it to get in front of my main goal, which is advancing the gospel to all people." Okay, so that was kind of his statement and his question to Charlie. How do I deal with this conundrum? I want to be patriotic, but I don't want patriotism to get in the way of my main goal, which is sharing Christ to the world. Very sincere person. This was Charlie's answer. He said, "The most important thing in the world is to know Christ and to make him known," acknowledging the man's desire there. "The second most important thing is to make sure that you can do the first." And that's where I come in. Your focus in life is on number one. I'm focused on number two. And he goes on to talk about how during COVID, I didn't write this all down, how during COVID the government shut down churches. He makes kind of an argument that they left strip clubs open, they left marijuana dispensaries open, they left Home Depots and Lowe's open. But then he said the Bride of Christ was considered non-essential and they shut that down. And they say separation of church and state, but then why is it they can come in and the state can come down and shut down the church? And then he goes on and he says this: when we stop caring about politics, the government gets so big it starts persecuting our religious liberty. And it's not a contradiction. The conservative agenda is a far greater fit with a biblical worldview than anything on the left. So if we want to know Christ and to make him known, we must have one ingredient: a free society. It is hard to know Christ and to make him known in countries where the gospel is not allowed to be told on the side of the street, like China or North Korea. When Christians fail to care about politics, politics will start caring about Christians. And we must understand that we are the recipients and the inheritors of a country that was founded by Christians so that the gospel can be spread. Okay, so what's wrong with all that? I'm gonna look at this because I don't agree with all his premises, and I want to say ahead of time that I do like the country I live in. I'm not one of these people that hates the United States of America. I'm thankful for the freedoms that we have. I'm thankful for the government we have. I think I would agree, although my context is pretty small, but I would probably have to admit, from what I can tell, it is probably one of, if not the most powerful country on earth, probably the most the richest country on earth, maybe in history. And I don't want to try to. My goal is not to try to prove myself right by downgrading the United States of America. However, these premises that Charlie would have presented to this man, number one, the first premise that I don't really agree with, is that it's not clear to me that true Christianity, and of course, sometimes you have definitions of words, and I'm a believer that definitions of words really matter. They carry a lot of weight, and you can use words in different ways, and so when we say Christianity and true Christianity, we can easily be talking about two different kinds of things, two different definitions. But you're probably all on the same page with me as far as definition of true Christianity, evangelical faith as taught in the New Testament. But on that premise, it's not clear to me that true Christianity actually does better in free, open societies. So here's what, in fact, there is some evidence that the opposite is true. If you look at the era after Constantine, and I think I said in one of the other messages, we've tried this whole trick before. We've had religious rule over nations, and you can see how that turned out for people. They ended up, killing each other and everyone in the middle. You know, they've gone on the cruise. In fact, that's how a lot of atheists are made, is because of what they've seen when Christians ruled the earth in government, using the term Christian rather loosely and maybe a different definition. But if you look at the time of Constantine, the time of the Reformation, and I'm not going to get that, but you can get examples, real life, real history examples of what happens when Christians rule. You don't have to go back. Another example is the Laodicean church. Lukewarmness was a result. I mean, you've probably all preached sermons or heard sermons preached where the Laodicean church is, if not directly, at least overtly suggested that we are the Laodicean church here in North America. And so we have this logical comparison that when things go well, when you have a free, open, maybe capitalistic society and everyone gets rich, well, what is the result to true Christianity? In Revelation, they became lukewarm. That's what Jesus said. Or you can have dead formalism, or really an assimilation into the world system, where at some point Christianity becomes something other than Christ likeness. And it actually, as it happens, becomes another form of government, and sometimes a worse form of government. Okay, now, it is true that Jesus was born in the time of great peace, the Pax Romana. It was a time of world peace, they say. But it is also true that Jesus was born a captive in his own nation. Okay, as a Jew, he was born a captive. He was under foreign ruler. And for them, it was not a free, open society. Jesus was not born during the golden age of Solomon, when there was just peace and prosperity. And really, that was the time when religion ruled a nation, and God allowed it to be that way. Jesus wasn't born during that time. Jesus wasn't born during the time of David, when David was out winning all the wars that he fought, and truly was a nation that was out destroying the nations. Jesus wasn't born during those times, during what we would call free, open societies that were conducive to Christianity. Jesus was born a captive with restricted movements, restricted limits on speech, what you could say. If you wanted to, you could get killed for saying certain things. And Jesus did get killed. And Christianity seemed to take off just fine in Jesus' time. Maybe better than any other time, oddly enough. And I don't think a lot of people would call that a free, open society as it really was compared to our society. Okay, so when you take the Apostle Paul in prison, you know that in Acts chapter 5, they were put in prison, they were beaten, they were told not to preach. That sound like a free, open society? He's one of the greatest evangelists that ever lived. I mean, he would put all of us to shame with our Bangladesh and Hunt, everything. You know, he's just the Apostle Paul. Wasn't a free, open society, according to our definition. But the gospel spread, and they rejoiced, and they were counted worthy to suffer, rejoiced that they were counted worthy to suffer for Christ. All over the world, even today, as I understand it, you hear a lot of things. And I'm not here necessarily hoping that we start getting persecuted. I'm just addressing what I believe is a false premise in what the Christian right will often promote and extol as virtues of why we should get involved in government. Okay, the second premise I have an issue with in this is that when he says there, when Christians stop caring about politics, politics will start caring about Christians. It's a nice catchy phrase. I think it kind of makes sense from a human standpoint. I do think we should care about politics. I think we should pray for the king. I don't think it's a shame to know that there's a war going on. I don't think it's wrong to pray that the war in Ukraine stops and to know, what the rules are. I think it's a good idea to know what taxes we should pay and to keep up on road restrictions and what you can haul. But again, I think it comes down to the terminology of what do you mean by the word care? Like, how should you actually care? If by care you mean, well, we should go to all the rallies and we should promote and vote, promote a certain candidate, and maybe even run for office, and all of that, then I disagree that we should care about politics. But if by care we actually mean, like John the Baptist did, when he walked into Herod's palace and said, that woman is not your wife. He cared about politics, okay? And John the Baptist, he did not walk in there and go into this whole thing comparing Herod to a worse option and then choosing to back Herod politically. That's not how John the Baptist did it. He compared Herod to the scripture, to Jesus Christ, and said, here's where you need to be. If by caring you mean like Paul standing before Felix and reasoning of righteousness, judgment, righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come, well, Felix cared about politics. And these people seem to be very successful ministries. Now, in the New Testament, whether it was Jesus or Paul or John the Baptist, I want to think about it from this angle. Because if you're a disciple of or a believer in the whole Turning Point USA way of doing things. I think we should think about this. When John the Baptist or Paul or Jesus went onto college campuses or stood before political parties or went to the Republican convention or whatever, their speeches, when they stood before kings, they always brought to bear the personal responsibility that that king had towards his maker. They always went straight for the jugular. It was like, you are an accountable human being before God that needs to be repent and become a follower of Jesus Christ. They never made comparisons and then chose the lesser of the two evils. And this was one of the things, you know, they didn't try to influence the king's politics. They didn't go into Felix or Herod and try to influence the king's politics to become Christian in maybe political ways. But they encouraged that king to wholly and altogether surrender his life and follow Jesus Christ. Which they themselves were the example of. And so it didn't need to be written down to not be in politics in the Bible. It is so plainly there that when Paul stood before Felix and invited him to his position, it was such a drastic position and change in kingdoms. You're literally having a king potentially repenting and changing allegiance to Jesus Christ and his kingdom, that he simply could no longer be king of his kingdom. And so this was really what Paul and Jesus and John the Baptist were asking of the secular kings of that day. Now, one of the conundrums we have that I have wrestled with a little bit myself is, well, what's wrong with having Christian influence in government? I mean, it seems like a good thing. What's wrong with having policies that ban abortion? I certainly don't mind if they make a law against slaughtering millions and millions of babies. I'm not convinced God doesn't appreciate that either. I mean, he holds kings' hearts in his hands, and I'm not sure how to look at all that. But here's the conundrum that I think that our people really need to think about, is that, and I'm not sure if I've thought this through enough to word it correctly, but I believe it's possible to have Christian influence in an ungodly man. So an ungodly man can, because of his upbringing, he can remember the words of Christ. He can remember, and it can be a tempering effect on his actions. I think the same can be true with government. You can have Christian influence in government. The problem is when you start to have government influence in Christianity. Okay, so at that point, it becomes compromise. Christianity, at some point, you're playing with the definition of what is true Christianity. And my contention is that anytime you're sharing the power source, like we talked about last time, you've got to compromise that you no longer, by the technical sense of the word true, are true Christianity. It's something else. It's nationalistic or something like that. Because they do have wildly different values, we talked about that, wildly different values and wildly different goals. And I find it very interesting how, and I don't know if I'm reading the Bible quite right or reading history right, as far as how many wives Herod had. You know, I'm sure they had polygamy and some of that stuff going on. But I think as far as we're told, Herod had one illegitimate wife, and John the Baptist called him out on it. I find it interesting that Donald Trump has far more illegitimate wives than Herod did. And nobody on the Christian right calls him out for it. And again, I ask, like, did the Bible change or did Christianity change? I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's a third option, but that's the only two I can think of. You know, if J.D. Vance or Lindsey Graham or You know, John Kennedy, and here again, I'm not the judge of man. I know they profess Christianity and all that, but I will just, and you know, if they would ever hear, if I could ever speak to them, I would say to them what I'm going to say here is that, you know, if they were to go into Donald Trump and tell Donald Trump what John the Baptist told Herod, how long do you think they'd be in government? Like 2 split seconds. he would fire them. He would get rid of them because it's not compatible. The principles of Christ, since they have never changed, still apply to government and kings today. So that's some of the things that the value and the definition of the words, you know, it no longer defines the definition of Christianity. Kind of can be changed according to people. So here's the thing: when we think about salt, and I know the title of this is salt, I'm going to get to that. But that discussion there kind of sets the backdrop. When we think about salt, I think as Americans and American Christianity, so you take this 200 million. Christians in America, and you throw out the word salt to them. You're the salt of the earth. What does that even mean? I mean, we got 200, you know, half. What did I say? Half a million Anabaptists that may know what the meaning of salt means. So here's the thing: when the word salt is just thrown into the vocabulary, what does that conjure up in your mind? You know, we have salt shakers. So you know, often it's I think of you know seasoning. You might think of, here in Pennsylvania, you might use salt on the roads a lot. So you think, well, you know, they're salting the roads, and what's that do to my car, and when I'm buying a used vehicle? The word salt. Maybe if you're health conscious, you think, you know, I don't know if it's high blood sugar or low blood sugar, but, you know, maybe you need to cut back on your salt or eat more salt or things like that. So what about when we think of salt of the earth people? You know, I've had complete non-religious people, as far as I could tell, unchurched people or very little church, they will be describing someone they know, maybe somebody they want to recommend to me and say, well, they're really good people. They're salt of the earth type people. What does that mean? You know, for most people, for most of that 200,000 people, I keep saying 200 million people that claim to be Christians, salt of the earth people probably means something. What comes to mind is somebody that's honest, hardworking, middle class probably. They're probably married, have a small family, involved in community projects. Maybe their children are involved in 4-H, various boards around you know the community, town, the town planning committee or whatever, the city council. They give their voice, talk about where the urban growth boundaries are. Maybe spend money and donate money on a community pool. They may or may not be church people. They probably have to take their children to soccer games. They probably heavily involved in sports. They like to hunt and ski a lot, go to Hawaii in the wintertime for 10 days vacation. That's probably what the majority of Christians in America think about when they think of salt of the earth, the type of person that's salt of the earth. I don't think very many people think of cross-bearing, selling all and following, personal living, sacrifice to God, separation from the world, not loving the world or the things that are in the world. These are not ideas that are conjured up in our head. And it probably does not cross our mind much, at least it's not a huge worry for us. I have things I worry about. I struggle with anxiety, but the salt that I know of, I don't know I've ever spent any time worrying about that salt losing its saltiness. I just don't ever worry about it. I open the drawer, I pull out the salt, I put it on my food. In my experience, it's always been salty. So what is the concern? And the thing that we need to remember is that when Jesus first commented on salt, his main concern was the idea of salt losing its savor or losing its saltiness. That was the first thing that he spoke about. And salt, it would lose its value. That was the concern with salt losing its savor. It would become meaningless and useless. Now, salt, if it became moist or water exposure, it would leach out all the soluble sodium, and then there would leave like a magnesium or a gypsum type material would be left, and it would look white. It could look white, but it'd be flavorless, and it would be no good. And one of the reasons this was such great concern is because salt was extremely valuable. And when it lost its savor, it lost its valuableness. So salt in those days was extremely expensive. I read at one place that it was on par with gold. So an ounce of salt was worth an ounce of gold. And one of the places we get our word, so this had a lot to do with the soldier economy. And I find this very, very interesting as we are soldiers of the cross. And so if you think of yourself, all right, we had some good topics on taking up the weapons of our warfare and all that. So you all think of yourself as soldiers. You're not in the United States of America. You're just in medieval Europe marching across. You're probably on a crusade. And you might be in trouble at some point. Okay, so you got paid, or you got a stipend for salt. That's where the word salary comes from. You got paid a certain amount of money each month so you could go and buy your salt. And there's all kinds of, you know, if you're worth your salt, or you know, something's pretty salty. There's all kinds of phrases and terminology that reflect this value of salt. So what the soldiers had to do is, a soldier marches on his stomach, okay? And the only way they could preserve food, meat especially, was with salt. And plus, they needed salt in their diet. Another thing salt was good for was purification of wounds. So if you got cut, which is extremely likely, it's something that happens a lot in battle, or you are just, you know, hurt yourself or got a sliver, salt is what purified. You know, gangrene is, and you know, all those infections would kill people by the thousands back in those days. They didn't have antibiotics, so they'd put salt in there. So salt, in that form and in that contest, was both extremely valuable. It was worth its weight in gold. It was your salary. It was how you got paid. And it was a necessity for life. It was a necessity. If you were going to be a good, healthy, strong, worthwhile soldier, you had to have your salt. And this is the reason, like, if you were a careless soldier, and you were just like, you know, you didn't keep your things in line, and you left your salt laying around, and it rained that night, and you woke up in the morning, and all that was left was a white residue, you were a man without salt. When all this was lost, salt had lost its savor, the salt was compromised. Now, when we think about compromised, you know, Balaam tried it. It happened to Solomon with all his foreign wives. Lot got compromised. There's a lot of examples. Men have tried it ever since. But Jesus used this simile. It was in the context of love not the world. Take up your cross. Lay down your sword. My kingdom is not of this world. All of the instructions in the Sermon on the Mount were made up as this value element for soldiers. This is the salt that you need to be worth something. And so the motivation to be this attractiveness. You know, how do we draw young people to that? We discuss this. You know, I was thinking about that. Salt is not normally used as an action verb. You don't get a lot of action. You don't think about salt as something exciting. If salt was salty, it's just doing its job. It was able to do vital things when applied to certain situations. And I find that this thing of being salty, we had at our school, we had Heritage Night. So for quite a few years, we had a school in the upper rooms that he loved to do things with a student. And for a lot of years, he had what was called Culture Night. And Culture Night was just the students they would pick. They would kind of team up, and they would pick different. You might have had something like this. So they would represent a country, basically. So they'd set up a booth, and they would have all the things. Maybe they had food. They'd dress up like the country they represented. It was very interesting. It became very, very popular, not just in our church, but a lot of community people would come. Who doesn't like to see children dressed up like North, like Koreans or Japanese, and not only that, you get to go around and you're completely full of ethnic food when you're done, when you make the circle. And so it was very popular. A lot of people come. Well, this last year he changed it up and he called it Heritage Night. And so they had a whole, it was about the martyrs, Anabaptist martyrs, and it was completely set up different. And he sent out a message to the group, the church chat there, and said, you know, you might want to think about it if you invite your neighbors and maybe tell them what's going on, because this is going to be different than anything they've ever experienced. And it was. It was, they had, the likeness of a martyr being burned. They had a skeleton there and they had all these write-ups. It was just completely, completely different. Who are the salt of the earth people? That's the question that sometimes it's helpful to see the exact opposite in order to represent a concept. And in Matthew chapter 23, verse 24 to 35, and I won't read all those, but Jesus is talking to them and he tells them, some of the Pharisees, that he goes, that upon you might come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, son of Berechias, whom ye slew between the temple and the altar. If we were to read, and I thought, we don't have the time, it's past time already, but if you read the context of those verses that I just read, those Pharisees, Jesus talked about them as whited sepulchers, and he just burns them with his words. It is an incredible speech he gives those Pharisees. And what you see there is Jesus speaking to men that represent the exact opposite of the salt of the earth. They were very pharisaical, very empty, unsalted people. Why? Because they didn't adopt and apply the Sermon on the Mount to their life. And so this blood of Abel, you know, I was thinking about that. When God said to Cain, what have you done? You know, the voice of your brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. And I don't really believe this, the blood itself was the salt, although maybe it could apply, but rather the saltiness in a person. And this is one of the things I would challenge our young people with. The saltiness in a person is that willingness to stand with and by the words of Jesus up and unto the point of death. That I will stand with those words no matter where they take me, no matter how they affect my life, and if I become the next martyr, so be it. But I will be salt in this earth. How can peaceful Anabaptists change America, starting in our own neighborhoods and nearby cities? We serve a king who turned the world upside down. How did he do it? I'll just leave you with the words in John 8:28-29. When ye have lifted up the Son of Man, then shall ye know that I am he, and that I do nothing of myself, but as my Father hath taught me, I speak these things. And he that sent me is with me. The Father hath not left me alone, for I do always those things that please him. Lord bless you.